Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. And I'm here in the studio at this moment with Dr. Lester Spence, author of Stare in the Darkness, The Limits of Hip-Hop and Black Politics. He's also an assistant professor of political science at Johns. Can I speak today? What is wrong with me? Johns Hopkins University. Lester, good to have you in the studio.
Hey, good to be back. Back on the block.
And before we start, the Reverend Jamal Bryan will be here in just a moment. I want to remind you all that to join us a week from yesterday, today. Today is Wednesday, right?
Yeah, yes.
It is, thank you. A week from today in Annapolis for the 2012 Annapolis Summit. We don't want you to miss a chance to have a conversation with Governor Martin O'Malley, Senate President Mike Miller, House Speaker Michael Bush, and me. Will be at the Calvert House in Annapolis on Wednesday, January the 11th. That's a week from today, from 7:30 to 10 a.m. So if you want to get tickets and join us there, please call 410-454-0500. That's 410-454-0500. Or you can email hfishman@bizjournals.com. It is a tradition in Annapolis. Every year we interview the governor, the speaker, and the president. It's your chance to have a dialogue with them about the issues you care about and to hear their takes on the issues that the state will be wrestling with in this coming session. So please join us there and call 410-454-0500. Tickets are always going fast for this event, and we would love to have you be there. It'll be taped for later airing on WEAA, taped for later airing on public radio on the Eastern Shore, taped for airing on cable TV here in Baltimore and around the state, and taped for airing on realnews.com, all that over around the world. So you want to be part of that, call 410-454-0500. Well, we're going to start off today's program talking about the Occupy the Dream movement. We've been covering, Occupy Wall Street a lot. Occupy Baltimore, Occupy D.C., Occupy New York, talking to folks in Oakland and Seattle and Denver and across the country who've been part of the Occupy movement. Even though the movement has been racially mixed, it was predominantly white across the country for the most part in most cities, but not completely. Something people started talking about, why isn't there a larger African-American presence in that movement? The civil rights movement in America, I would say in some ways the elders of the civil rights movement, though not all of them, the ones who were there from the beginning of the civil rights movement in the 60s, came together with this idea to occupy the dream, which Lester wrote about on his blog. And we're going to talk about that this hour with Lester and with Dr. Jamal Harrison Bryant. The Reverend Bryant, of course, will be here in a moment, who is a pastor of the Empowerment Temple here in Baltimore. So, Lester, and you wrote a blog about it. Mm-hmm. You've been following Occupy very closely.
Yeah, yes, I have. And I've done some work with them. I've talked to a number of the members. I've been there when I was at McKeldin Square. I've been there a few times.
Your thoughts on what Occupy the Dream means?
About Occupy the Dream?
Yeah.
I think it represents kind of a natural attempt that I put natural in quotes to kind of bridge the Occupy Wall Street movement and the African American community. But where I have challenges is in the idea that there is that a bridging needs to occur, right? Or if a bridge needs to occur, that it needs to take the particular shape that perhaps people in Occupy the Dream want it to take, right? So first, I would actually argue that even to the extent that Occupy Baltimore represents, so it is racially, there are a number of people who aren't white involved with Occupy Baltimore and McKeldin Square, but actually, let's say it didn't. Let's say it was all white, or let's say leadership was all white. To me, what the Occupy Wall Street movement represents is the first kind of modern 21st century open source movement. And what I mean by that is it's not necessarily an organization, so to speak. It's just an idea and a series of tactics that accompany that idea. And those tactics are tactics, and even the label until the latter stages could be deployed by anybody interested in deploying them, right? So maybe about a month or so ago, if you were to go to the Occupy Baltimore website, it said Occupy Baltimore was a group of people at McKeldin Square, right? But there was a time when Occupy Baltimore could have potentially been anything, right? So if somebody wanted to organize at Coppin State and use the label Occupy Baltimore, they could have. You know, if somebody wanted to use it here at Morgan, they could have. If somebody wanted to use it at Hopkins, somebody wanted to use it at East Side, the West Side, et cetera. All they had to do was have a general sense that they wanted to fight against income inequality or some type of inequality, and then maybe they wanted to do so nonviolently. To that extent, it doesn't necessarily – a bridge isn't necessarily what's required there, right? And as much as – in that case, we don't need, quote-unquote, black leaders to meet with, quote-unquote, Occupy leaders. What we need somehow is, if anything, kind of a proliferation of tactics and ideas, so perhaps communities that didn't feel as if McKeldin Square was for them, they could move for issues that were more important to them, right? So people who are dealing directly with the foreclosure issue could use those tactics and deal directly with foreclosure. People who, black transgendered youths who are being subjugated by the police could potentially use those tactics to deal with that issue, right? So that's the first critique. But assuming that a bridge is required, I'm just kind of skeptical of the idea that the bridge that we needs to be bridged by quote-unquote civil rights leaders who themselves often don't necessarily have direct constituencies that can hold them accountable, right? So in that case, what we end up in at worst is like middlemen who then work between these larger black communities and then the forces of Occupy Wall Street. And that can, at its worst, disempower black people that the brokers want to speak on behalf of.
Disempower people because disempower people because it is so centralized, because it is not a local movement.
Yes, in part because it's decentralized. So one of the critiques that we don't really broach with the civil rights movement anymore, but a critique that was made during its time, that it was male-centered and it was charismatic leader-centered, right? So I remember one of the critiques – well, when I say I remember, I mean, hell, I'm 42 – but one of the critiques that was weighed against Martin Luther King Jr., for example, was that it was like he was doing drive-by organizing. So he'd come by, he'd give a really, really charismatic speech, he'd rile people up for an event, and then he'd leave. And then all of a sudden, local organizers would find it so difficult to reach and get communities to move for themselves because they were kind of waiting for the word from on high. And that was a critique that I believe followed him at least until he began to speak out against the Vietnam War. And I believe it followed him to his death. Now, that's a dynamic that black communities and other communities have had to wrestle with throughout the modern era. And I think that that's particularly problematic in this moment.
So 410-319-8888 is the number here. We're talking to Dr. Lester Spence. We're now joined in the studio as well by Dr. Jamal Harrison Bryant, who's founder and pastor of the Empowerment Temple AME here in Baltimore and a leader of the Occupy the Dream movement. And Jamal Harrison Bryant, good to see you. It's been a while.
Yes, it has.
Welcome to the
good
studio.
Good to see you.
Good to see you.
My pleasure.
And Dr. Lester Spence on the other side here. 410-319-8888 is the number here. So let me ask you to describe a bit the Occupy the Dream movement. There are a lot of people I know who've they've even heard of this.
Yes. Occupy Dream is what I'm calling Occupy Wall Street 2.0. It's an attempt to try to bring the African-American community into the conversation, the dialogue, and the demonstration of what the Occupy Wall Street movement has been doing for the last 3 months effectively, in adding a little bit of the old civil rights technique to what it is that they're doing in mass demonstration.
And what would that mean?
That means not using the tents, not staying the night, but having a more fun. that would be the bottom line.
Are you killing me?
Jamal, you don't want to stay in a tent?
You're killing me, man.
You don't want to stay in a tent?
So, on January 16th, will be The recognition of Martin Luther King's birthday. So what we're doing in 13 cities across the country is doing demonstrations outside of the Federal Reserve Bank. And I just got off of a mobilization call, and it's an exciting time.
Now, one of the things that we were talking about here, folks, we do want to join us because we've had lots of conversations, you know, over the last several months about the Occupy movement. Mm-hmm. We've had a lot of people from New York, from communities of color, who have talked about why that movement was not a white movement, as people tried to portray it. Some places clearly were more white than communities of color, like in Seattle, but Oakland was a very different picture, as it was in many of the cities. Baltimore was really interesting in that the young people who started the movement here in the city, who were mostly white for the most part, but there were many who were not, came face to face with the heart of what the society has done to the poorest among us, because when it was the 40 people who were pushed out of the square in Baltimore, mm-hmm. 23 of those people, when that happened, asked for a ride to a homeless shelter. So the majority of people who were left there were, for the most part, African-American, but not completely, and homeless. And many of those who did not take a ride to the homeless shelter were also homeless. The vast majority of people left in that place of safety for them were homeless people. Yeah. So it was as if the movement, and that happened across the country, came in direct, not conflict, came into direct work and with people who were homeless and the poorest end of our society. So that, and that was really a very transformative thing, I think.
One of the things that was the impetus of the Occupy the Dream is really taking the mantle of knowing when Dr. King was killed, he was formulating the Poor People's Campaign.
Yes.
Which was to really occupy Washington, D.C., and would have been the forerunner of what Occupy Wall Street is doing and looking like on today, to really paint the picture twofold, that the next step after civil rights was civil rights, which is economic development, and that the second phase is that poverty is not a black issue or a Latino issue or a minority issue. It is now an American issue. And so the reason why the January 16th date was called was really a call to action so that America does not get lulled to sleep because of the monument being unveiled, thinking that civil rights is now just an asterisk in history where it's still a present-day issue.
So yeah, that is interesting. And as someone who is a veteran, of the Poor People's Campaign, who mm-hmm. camped out in the mud for that time there in D.C., it was one of the first occupations. I mean, not in the 20th century, but it was a huge one. And for many reasons fell apart at the end. But it did. It drew poor people together from across America, black, white, Puerto Rican, Mexican, Native American, from all across this country. And it was pretty an amazing thing to behold. So the question is, well, one of the things that happens in all these movements, what happened in the Civil Rights Movement, other than the speeches that Dr. King gave and other people gave around the country that you alluded to a moment ago, mm-hmm. Lester, is that it was a result of organizing on the ground, whether it was the organizing women did in Montgomery that pushed the churches and King to participate, or whether it was what the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee did throughout the South and organizing voters and farmers, and CORE did down South and organizing voters and farmers. It was organizing people, or Fannie Lou Hamer in Mississippi, coming out of the sharecropper, organizing yeah. people in the South, that pushed it because they were organizing masses and masses of people to come out and oppose what was going on and to say we had a different world. So how does that fit into where we are now, do y'all think?
Well, so those two tendrils, so that organizing tendril, which was largely run by, but not solely, run by SNCC, right, but run by the students, which was bottom-up, you know, straight up self-organized. That's the tendril that we have to get back to, and we've actually been missing. So what we've had is we've consistently had, particularly around symbolic events and holidays, we've had mass mobilizations where we've had people come in large numbers to speak truth to power. But what we haven't effectively done is connected those movements to the organizing, to that organizing tension. And the thing is, it's not like organizing is it done? And it's not like organizing hasn't been done by folks in Baltimore, by black folk in Baltimore, right? So from January 16th to January 20th, the Occupy folk, and it's going to be a number of people of color, a number of youth, are going to be occupying the site of the youth prison. It's not going to be long-lived. It's not like it's going to be permanent. It's like a temporary occupation, right? And what that does is it calls attention to the issue, like kind of like a mass demonstration. But what it does that mass demonstrations don't really have the capacity to do in the same way is it empowers people to literally reclaim their space and to work for themselves, right? So kind of the challenge, even as I can understand why Occupy the Dream was created in some ways, part of the challenge is that there has to be some way to connect to grassroots organizing on the ground, to organizing that involves tactics other than just everybody coming together en masse, right? Does that make sense?
It makes sense.
So I mean, but you know, Reverend Brian, I'm just curious what you would, what you think will come of this movement that you're talking about, Occupy the Dream. I mean, it's you know, a lot of people, not you necessarily, a lot of people have been in the clergy community in Baltimore and other places have been criticized for not being involved,
right?
For being, you know, just behind their church walls and not in the community and not pushing for political, social, economic change.
I said to the Occupy founders, as it were, in New York a couple of weeks ago, that I really felt like the black church and the civil rights community owed Occupy Wall Street a thank you for the wake-up call, is that they have really done what the black church has been derelict in their responsibility of doing, is sounding the alarm about economic injustice and about the housing issues. And much of the fallback has been that when it's been portrayed in the press, the message has not been clear. Civil rights, to which you are the veteran of, I'm the first generation on the other side of that. Civil rights, the clear distinction between civil rights and Occupy is that the focus or the enemy was clear. And so in Birmingham, in Montgomery, we're marching until that whites-only sign comes down.
Right.
We're walking until we can sit in the front of the bus.
Right.
So to talk about economic justice, which is almost an invisible entity, it's hard to fight what you can't see. And so the translation or the lost in translation that has happened to the black community is the black community was slow to get involved in Occupy Wall Street because it's almost Wall Street, Occupy Wall Street is almost like Juneteenth. They just got the news that we're dealing with poverty and unemployment and a bad housing crisis. Malcolm X said some years ago, when America catches a cold, black America has pneumonia. So we were waiting for everybody else to get NyQuil because we had already had the symptoms of this. And so now we're realizing we can't afford to sit on the sideline. We've got to get on the front line of it.
So you say something, let's open the phones otherwise. Folks are calling in and get them in here. 410-319-8888. We're talking about Occupy the Dream. Demonstration will be held on the 16th, Martin Luther King Day. They'll also be here in Baltimore. Will be an Occupy the site where the
youth
prison was supposed to be built.
Yeah.
Will be built. Maybe it won't be built. We'll see.
We're praying won't be built.
Yeah, it won't be. I'm sorry.
Before you go to those lines, the bigger issue, and I'm appreciative of the professor bringing this up, is that the construction of the juvenile detention center is a financial issue. And the irony or the slap in the face is that our dear mayor can find the availability to build the construction of a juvenile detention in the same breath of closing 12 recreation centers. If we've got the money, put the money into the recreation centers or these empty libraries or these teachers who are having to buy supplies out of pocket. So since we have found the money, let's use it towards a system so that our young people can be able to compete on a global stage.
Let's open the phones. 410-319-8888. And Kurt, you're on the air.
I just want to say, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Kurt.
Thank you. I'm so proud of you, Jamal. You're taking this stance. I've been proud of you all along, but I'm particularly proud of this stance.
Kurt, you still there?
Oh, that's the man.
No, something just occurred.
I mean, the one compliment I get all day, I can't even hear it.
You can't even hear it?
It's a conspiracy. J. Edgar lives.
There he is. Kurt's back. Kurt's back.
Yeah, how to empower themselves. Because what has been absent is this idea of how do we go about, you know, doing this? How do we go about empowering our young people and getting our young people to access this country in order to create a better life for themselves? And as the families are in crisis, there's this absence of role models. And so if the civil rights movement did nothing, it provided us with models. It provided us with examples of what dignified men do, what right. responsible men and women do when they see social injustice in their communities. And so I'm proud, and I just want to encourage everybody to be persistent. And this is not, you know, I'm an educator, as some of you may know, and so I get frustrated sometimes with my staff when we abandon certain policies because we don't have an immediate sort of impact, right? But over time, we begin to make change. We begin to create the same sense of urgency in young people, you know, et cetera. So we just have to stick with this. We have to continue and realize the importance of modeling for our youth and others as we try to make this world a better place for a larger scale of people. And just thank you. Okay. Thank you, brothers. I really, really appreciate and applaud this initiative.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kurt. Thanks for that call. I mean, I think that leads me to a question. Why don't we go to the phones, and I'll come back to my questions in a minute. So I'll let people get the say in here. 410-319-8888. Michael, you're on the air.
Scott here, Equity Matters. Listen, I think the real exciting thing is that you have a number of institutions stepping up to the plate. So the Black Church and Pastor Bryant, it's just a great thing. But, I mean, I think we have to keep in mind that, you know, there was a strategic decision made in the last generation by civil rights folks to make a lot of the framing of economic and civil rights in a very personal responsibility mode. And so now we're sowing and reaping what was planted then. And, you know, part of the tough work that we do around the country at many of the places you mentioned is trying to frame stuff systemically so that people can understand that burden and opportunity congregate unfairly. And so the challenge has been, I think, in many of the Occupy movements, as I talk to my colleagues around the country in the Place Matters movement, as we try to connect this really robust research and evidence to important framing and messaging, because it's not just enough to be right, you got to frame it right. That has been really the challenge, is that it's not resonating with folks, and we have to find a better way of not just being right about the data and the research about why poor people exist in this country in the way that they do, but we have to frame it right, and that's been the challenge. So the Black Church has always been a beacon and a communicator and an honest broker in the community, so that's critical. But we have to keep in mind that we're undoing some of the things that were not done the right way last time. So it is indeed version 2.0, but there's a lot of folks out here doing it. We're on the ground. I know all you guys work with Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle.
Right.
So when we interfaced with Occupy, that was the first thing we said. We said, listen, there are folks that have been doing this a long time and will be doing it a long time after you pack up those tents in the cold and go home. And their lack of presence here means that you're not speaking. There's some truth that's not being told, and they're not showing up. And so you have to fix that, and that's about framing and messaging. So I'm thrilled, and you know, we'll stay tuned, and we'll keep cranking out our research and supporting the efforts.
Thank you.
All right, Michael, thank you so much, and I owe you a video. I'll be seeing you soon with it.
My pleasure. Thanks, all right, brother. Appreciate it.
So before we go back to the phones with Bert and John, our next two callers up, one of the things that Michael Scott was saying about people when the faces of Black America of the streets were not in at Occupy in large numbers, isn't that in some ways isn't that a matter of lack of organizing and organization taking place? By that I mean that in the poorest communities in Baltimore, mm-hmm. be they black or Latino or even white communities in Baltimore, there's not that kind of organization going on where people are, in other words, the people are gathering people together to demand a different way of being and living, demanding a different kind of community, demanding different institutions, demanding a response.
Let me, for the record, fall on the sword as the black church. I think that part of that disconnect was the absence of the black church assuming its rightful position. This is the very first time in American history that the black church has contracted laryngitis and has not spoken truth to power, is that you're not seeing that grass root swell because somewhere post-1968, and the professor is better with a time frame than I, post-1968 to 2011, the black church messaging and theology shifted from community advancement to personal achievement. It was about what I could get, not how it is that we move the body forward. And so as a consequence, you're not seeing, even if you just plan a microphone in any of the large churches, you can go weeks without hearing a message about community development, community empowerment, about economic development, where far beyond you would not have heard of, that you can sit for hours and watch Christian television and not hear one message that talks about social responsibility. And so I think what Occupy has done is not just speaking to the powers on Capitol Hill or the State Department or City Hall, but really the pew is now dictating to the pulpit. This is where you're going to have to come and meet us, because the pulpit has not, in fact, led the charge in that direction.
Well, so I'd say it a bit different way. First thing I'd say is that I wouldn't necessarily talk about the black church. I talk about black churches, right? Because there are churches, even here in Baltimore, with a history of speaking truth to power.
Absolutely. Right? I come out of one.
Yeah. But there are others that don't. And even if we were to go back during Martin Luther King's movement, I mean, they had to browbeat Martin Luther King mm-hmm. to actually leading that bus boycott.
Right.
You know, it wasn't like there was all types of people doing. Right. There were people in churches that organized. So I think that one of the struggles now is that, and this is the thing I push, is it's a black politics issue, right, where black people, and I've talked about this before in the show, you got black people with loot, you've got black people with just a little loot, and you got black people who are broke, right? So
and none of the three of them are organized.
Well, but there are people. Leaders of the Beautiful Struggle were organizing some of those folk. The Baltimore Algebra Project are organizing. There are people that are doing organize. It's not large, but let's not act like there aren't people doing it.
Are there representatives?
Right?
Absolutely. So, but I'm talking about in terms of movement as we would define it, there is not a movement afoot that is moving in that direction. Are there people of conscious minds, of conscious thinking? Absolutely. But can we say in the city of Baltimore, when you drive through and see beyond Johns Hopkins and the Inner Harbor, where there is just, 18,000
yeah.
vacant homes?
That's right.
That there hasn't been any challenging to that system in an organized way. Have there representatives? Absolutely.
What I would say is that it's not large, right? So the civil rights movement doesn't occur out of nowhere. So I'm going to use history, right? It doesn't occur all of a sudden, but it wasn't like all this stuff, all of a sudden everybody was, it was there. There were these little movements, there were these little attempts to organize that didn't catch for whatever reason, and then all of a sudden they caught. So we're in the middle of one of those movements. All I'm suggesting is that it's not like stuff isn't occurring. Now, I do agree that for the most part, black churches have been promoting more of a prosperity gospel, not necessarily empowerment temple, but more of a prosperity gospel message than a message of liberation theology. But that's a different. So, I'm making a different claim.
So we have to take a break. When we come back, I'm going to talk about what the messages that needs to be talked about here, and if in some ways it is extra political. In terms of political campaigns and running for office, the extra political aspect of this. We'll come back to that. And also, as soon as we come back, we will talk with John in Hartford County and Dr. Burt in Baltimore. 410-319-8888 is the number. We'll be right back with the Reverend Jamal Bryant and Dr. Lester Spence. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ. MeQ is Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.mecu.com. Remember, it is a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you, and you get something in the end for yourself. www.mecu.com, or you can go to steinershow.org click on their banner. We're here in the studio with Dr. Lester Spence, who is author of Stare in the Darkness, The Limits of Hip-Hop and Black Politics, assistant professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University. The Reverend Dr. Jamal Harrison Bryant, founder and pastor of Empowerment Temple AME here in Baltimore City, and leader of the Occupy the Dream movement, which is going to lead demonstrations. We'll talk about more on the 16th of this month. 410-319-8888. I was going to go to the phones, but it looks like Lester Spence is going to come through the microphone here, so I think we should...
I apologize. I was trying to figure out, I wanted to be concise, and I couldn't get to my point. So what we haven't do, we have a lack of imagination, right? And part of it is because we are still consistently looking at marches and demonstrations, right? So what our task to do, what Occupy gives us the space to do, is to reclaim some of that civil disobedience stuff. Right. So one thing we do know about black churches is that there are likely a number of black churchgoers in these churches that are dealing with foreclosure issues. Right.
A whole lot.
Yeah, right. So there are a number of things we can do about that. But one thing that one tactic that Occupy brings to the table is actually occupying foreclosures. Like, what would it be like? What would the response be if a member of Empowerment Temple was dealing with foreclosure, knew the date they were coming to take their home, and the people came and everybody from Empowerment Temple were at that house? Like, no, we are not taking it. And then that's where the religious power comes in, the moral authority comes in. That's the thing we have to reclaim. It's not like we don't have a movement it's that lack of imagination, right? That's the thing.
Jamal, you want to say something before we jump on the phone? I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think that a couple other things have to happen in terms of the educational process, as well as where we will be slow to that, Professor, is the church. And again, I know you're making the distinction, but the churches who had a role in pushing them into a place of being in foreclosure, of giving what you call in the prosperity gospel, mm-hmm. Of signing up for this house with this balloon mortgage that you know you can't afford. Yeah. And then once I got it, I go and testify in church, the Lord did this for me. But then when I lose it, the devil's after me.
Yeah.
It was never about the educational process that needs to happen. And so some education will have to happen from the pulpit. How do I then move forward after this moment is through? And if you signed up in a good mortgage, were you a good steward of what it is that you had? So we'd have to be very clear on how it is that we execute that.
Let me open the phones again. 410-319-8888. First to John, then to Dr. Burt, and then to Leo. John, you're on the air.
Good evening, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you for calling.
I have a brief question and a brief statement.
Sure.
The question is, why would anybody be against building that institution? And do you really think that these kids that are caught up in this thug culture would avail themselves of a library? You know, or a rec center. The only thing I see them doing at that rec center is posting up to establish it as a base of operations to sell their drugs and peddle their violence. Okay? If you want them to read, let them read their charge paper. I don't know about you, but I do travel. I don't live in the city, but the reason I left 10 years ago and the reason that I'm very wary when I have to travel for work and whatnot is I see what's in these streets. Trust me, I want them to quadruple the capacity. That's what's needed.
Now, talking to you, the president. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And I'll tell you why the church has been, he's right about one thing. The church has been very silent, but I'll tell you why. Because they're so afraid of diminishing their coffers in the collection plate by speaking out against something that might be offensive to their political friends. They spend too much time cozying up to these sorry administrations like the one that was just elected and doing other things, reckless things, philandering with their congregation and things of that ilk. You know, they don't care. I mean, I'm not saying that the Martin Luther King was the last one, but the people of that character are very, very rare. And that's in any clergy, and that's not just the black church. you know. But really, I think you're on the wrong track when you say you want to discourage them from building that institution. What do you think is going to happen to these people if you just give them a pass? They're going to continue to wreak havoc on our streets and victimize the citizenry of Baltimore.
Gentlemen, you want to respond to John?
Yeah. I'm going to believe that John is really just acting as devil's advocate on the night, because leaving that question open is, what do we want? Is we want the young people to be educated. We want them to be to dream. We want them to realize that there's another opportunity and option of life. For you to just turn them over to the prison system says that you're giving up on an entire generation. You're talking to a young man who failed out of the 11th grade, got kicked out of Baltimore City College High School from the teachers and the school system, and said, I couldn't learn, but my community surrounded me and said that there is some value in you and you are worth the investment. And as a consequence, I've been able to make some deposits back into the community. And so I hope that the young people who are listening don't in any way get discouraged to believe that society at large is really wiping them out. When we're at a place where Baltimore Public Schools is at a 65% dropout rate, there's got to be an alternative. When we're really living with the reality that this is the first generation that will potentially live underneath of the means of their parents, that the American dream is now going into reverse, at some point we've got to shine a glimmer of hope and pray that that's not a train in the tunnel, but that's light at the end of the tunnel. And so for us to just be doomsday prognosticators would say that we give up on society, we give up on the next generation, and as a consequence, we give up on our own children.
Lester,
I would just say, working on the assumption that he isn't the devil's advocate, part of our struggle is in this moment and consistently has been to have kind of a political battle within Black communities about what's right and what's wrong. And in this case, you know, I can easily imagine a circumstance where John and I would be probably on the different ends of the political struggle on almost every issue that he articulated.
But let's listen to what John said, though. One of the things John articulates and what he just said, at least from my perspective, and then we'll go back to the phones, is that the reality that there are a lot of young people in our communities who, for a myriad of reasons, have lost the way. Not just lost the way, but that the violence of poverty inside them has turned into their own personal violence that they take out on the rest of society. And that's real. I mean, that stuff goes on every day, which is why our children, some of them, are afraid to walk from their front door to their school. And that has to be addressed. So I guess people ask the question, okay, you don't want to build a prison, then what do you want to do that's different? What are you going to do to protect us from thugs who do exist in our streets? And then where do you take it, and what do we do to address that? And if you don't want to spend the $300 million, whatever it is, on this new prison, then what do you want to spend it on, and what do you do with those kids who do need, and some kids do need to be separated from the rest of us until we can help them get their act together?
I think first, he wasn't even willing to support education while kids are in prison. So I don't believe that kids should be in prison. I don't believe I don't believe in the youth charged as an adult as a category. But that's what we're talking about. Youth charged as adults.
Yes, no,
we're not talking
that.
About kids going to juvie, what they call it, baby booking. We're talking about youth charged as adults. I don't believe that category should exist.
That's our show tomorrow, by the way.
Yeah. John didn't even indicate support for educating people, kids who are in jail, right? And that's the thing. So it's like, yeah, we have to engage in a number of processes within these populations to get people to understand that, to give people alternatives, to help people imagine life outside of dealing, life outside of battery, of breaking and entering. But what we have to do simultaneously is engage in a really strong critique against people who have the idea that these people aren't worth saving, that they aren't even worth educating.
Let me get back to the phones here, because I do want to come back to the 16th, 410-319-8888. Dr. Burt, you're on the air.
Hello. Hi. This is Robert Burt, a homeowner.
Robert, how are you? Welcome.
How are you doing? Okay. Let me just, since this person brought up this thing about what to do with these kids, what do you do with them? Well, I don't know if people are cognizant of this, but during the movements in the 60s, when the movement tempo picked up, actually the crime rate actually went down. A part of the question would be that how we begin to redeem youth through a struggle and a process of building a new community and ultimately a new society. How do you inspire people with new ideas of possibility? I think that that is one of the things that a new movement could do. That's just one of the things you want to think of. I mean, I remember reading that in Montgomery, the black crime rate dropped by 50% during the Montgomery bus boycott.
Right.
The thing is that I think when people are empowered, when they have a vision, when they have hope, they behave differently.
Yes.
Than when they're hopeless and inclined to become cynical. And ultimately, you know, I think it was Eric Fromm says, if life cannot, life tends to expand and actualize itself, and it can't do so creatively, it does so destructively and even self-destructively. So we have to think about inspiring people for a new vision of a new kind of society in which human beings can live and become fully human.
Awesome.
Now, the other thing I would want to say, since I want to get back to the thing that some person brought up at the end, and that I forget which one of you was, but you were saying something about the last period of Dr. King, that phase of the movement. It wasn't just about Dr. King, of course, but the last phase, the Poor People's Campaign.
Right.
And since it seemed to me that that is an unfinished agenda, and the Occupy movement offers
yes.
the opportunity to resume the unfinished business. And I wonder whether we're cognizant of that. But I think there's something else that's going on, and this is very important. I read some of the Occupy demonstrations, and you hear people saying, we are the 99%.
Right, right.
I mean, this is very important. I'm not even sure to what extent people in the Occupy movement understand the implicitly revolutionary implications of what they're saying. Because what they've already done, to whatever extent they've thought it through or not, I mean, and I was at some of them, and I've certainly been thinking about it, is that we are, in fact, confronted with a certain kind of society in which essentially a small clique of millionaires and billionaires run everything. They're dispossessing everyone, and part of what's happening, yeah, for black folk is old news, poverty, yeah. But what's important about this, it seems to me, that for a lot of reasons, including globalization, the electronic revolution, we've been going on and on, but it seems to me that one of the things that's happening is that increasingly the corporate global capitalist economy is pushing more and more middle-class and working-class white people down to the level of the masses of African-Americans and Latino people. And that's part of what's happening. Now, maybe this is something that offers us a new possibility of thinking about creating a new kind of society, in a society like ours, you know, which is wealth as it is, right? It is a crime for people to live homeless, to be hungry, for millions of children to go hungry. And can we create a new kind of society in which these things will not happen? A society which is more cooperative, that isn't based on ruthless competition and endless profiteering.
So, Robert, I'm sorry, we have a lot of people wanting to cut or who online here waiting to get in. So,
this is something I guess the Occupy movement can look at, and I think this is what Dr. King was getting at.
Robert, thank you so much, and I do want to talk about that, but I'd like you to join in here, Jamal.
Yes, I think he gave a wonderful backdrop. I hope you all recorded it. I need
it's all recorded.
I need that verbatim. He really set up really the groundwork in the preface. For Occupy the Dream is to, in fact, pick up that drop torch of Dr. King, that this is, in fact, the next lap of the civil rights movement. I want to add, and I'd be interested for professors buy-in, that part of what has pushed us back in civil rights is the false notion that we've arrived, that it's over. Now that we have a black president and a black mayor and a black comptroller and a black president of city council, we have overcome. I think that what
they have,
what our dear guest says really is that somebody get a book of matches and set the fire again. That it's time for us to really wake up from this lull and realize that this is a pervasive. Endemic problem that needs to be addressed, and what greater time than this presidential election season and make this the focal point of the conversation.
So what, again, what is going to happen on the 16th? What is Occupy the
January the 16th in 13 cities across the country at Federal Reserve Banks. The closest one here would be Washington, D.C., obviously, from 10 until 1. The black church community is going to be merging and marrying with the Occupy Wall Street community that's already been on the ground since October the 17th and really giving peaceable demonstration in the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. and the Civil Rights Movement with a declaration to federal banking, which is the starting point of the whole bailouts that took out that took place. That's where the checks were written from, that you bailed out these corporations, bailed the people out. That this is really a cause of alarm for all of us to become engaged and involved in the process as we address the problem.
One of the things, you know, I was thinking about here as we go back to the phones is as I was listening to Robert Burt speak, who used to be a philosophy professor here, I think he's now at Coppin, and he talks about building a different society. One of the things we never talk about when we talk about King, which we will debate on his birthday here on this program, is he was a man who talked about Christian socialism and called himself a Christian socialist, a word that people don't want to utter because of what it might mean in American society today to many people. But that's what he talked about. And what Robert Burt was talking about in terms of what is the vision, what you want. What we want is building a society that's built on cooperation, not just on not merely just on competition and on a cutthroat society. I mean, if there's a message in all this to, as a direct action takes place, for people to kind of talk about what kind of world we want.
Right.
That is the conversation to have in some ways.
Absolutely. And I think it begins, Dr. King, as much as he quoted the Bible, cross-referenced the Constitution as his base. This is our accountability level, and this is the Bible being our integrity base. If you go to our website, OccupyDream.org, you'll see that we've got a theological position paper that's been put together by some of the greatest theological minds of our time, as well as what is it that we're asking for. Occupy the Dream on January 16th is looking for three things. Number one is absolute security of the Pell Grants, so that they are not in danger, not a red line item on the budget, that our young people will be able to have an education and able to compete. Number two, back to what Professor spoke to, calling for an immediate moratorium on foreclosures. The banks have, in fact, acknowledged that they did predatory lending but have not done the right kind of compensation. I think Bank of America gave $350 million nationwide, which really isn't even a drop in the bucket, until there's a full senatorial hearing on the issue and people have an opportunity to refinance their homes. Number three, we're asking for, Mark, $100 billion from Wall Street for economic development, for job training, and for seed capital for entrepreneurship. There are a whole lot of businesses and jobs that have been exported post-1984 that the corporations have no business, have no intentions of ever bringing back. And so there's got to be a substitution. When you look at 2009 to 2011, the average unemployed person was unemployed for 26 weeks, the highest that it's been since 1929 in the Great Depression. There's got to be some redress to that. And then on the backdrop, after you've worked, you've got a group up in D.C. that's trying to take away your Social Security so that even when you stop working, there's nothing for you to collect. So something has to be addressed, and I'm hoping that January 16th, we enlarge the base of that conversation.
So along similar lines, a more local level, from January 16th to January 20th, folks will be occupying the site of the hopefully not to be built youth prison complex.
Can you give the address where that is?
I don't have it. Do you have that? Let me see.
We'll get it.
Yeah, we'll get it. And then on January 21st, there's a mayor's budget forum at, is it Silburn Arboretum? Or maybe
Silburn Arboretum.
Silburn Arboretum. From what I understand, the budget, the mayor's been having a number of public budgetary meetings, but the number of people who've been coming to these budgetary meetings has been very, very, very small. So the idea here is not necessarily to occupy and disrupt these meetings, but to actually occupy and participate in these meetings to increase the number of people who can actually have a say in how Baltimore's money is being spent.
Let's try to get a caller or two in here before the end of the hour, if possible. Very quickly, Abdul, you're on the air. Abdul, you're on the air.
Yes.
Abdul is gone. Let's try to...
Hello? Hello?
Hello, is this Abdul?
Yes.
You're on the
Abdul.
Air.
Oh, peace be unto you, Brother Jamal.
And unto you.
Yeah, very powerful name.
Bless you.
We lost the way, Jamal, saving our children, saving ourselves. What you just explained about your own growth has been a model. And you have connections with youth.
Yes, sir.
And they're also, that is a model for me. That's the epitome for me. But let me say this. Also, the courageous advancement that the children took in Alabama that brought back that spirit that Dr. King had. You know, those children are the ones that went out there and they suffered. Those four girls and the rest of those children that made those different moves out there to go back out there and take on that society. And when I hear you and I see your track record with dealing with youth and your connecting with youth, that is where we as adults have failed because we don't get out there and we don't connect. We can talk, we can be rhetorical, but the main thing, we have to be out there in those streets and connect with those youth. We may not save all of them, but there are those that we can connect to, as I see your example as a model is, and has been from the colleges, the Baltimore Community College. Many times you went there to many meetings and met with the graduates of youth and different other people in other places. That is the example there, and many of us should follow behind that example and get out there and get ourselves involved with these young people.
And Abdul, we're just about out of time, and I think
Thank you.
I appreciate you being part of the show today and calling in.
So real quick, the address for the youth jail occupation is 600 Monument, is that right?
Yeah, Monument.
Yeah, 600 Monument Street.
That's what it'll be. East Monument, isn't
East
it?
Monument.
East
yep.
Monument,
yep.
Yes.
Yep.
Right.
Let me say to all of our listeners, and we're partnering, Mark, with Occupy Baltimore, that those who cannot get to D.C., from 10 to 1, I ask that you will please stand in allegiance with Occupy Baltimore at the said address that whole week. I believe that they'll be there, Professor, the whole week, Monday through Friday. Is that correct? Monday through Friday. So I ask that you would, even if you can't, participate on the national stage January 16th in D.C. Please do what you can to stand with Occupy Baltimore. Our children are worth the investment. They're worth their time. And get your kids up on that day. Do not drop them off at the mall. Don't let them just have an Xbox festival. But let them please be a part of it. I'd love to see young people there in strong numbers because, in reality, that prison is built with your child in mind.
That's
so
right.
let's do something to reverse the curse.
And we will have a report on all that on our show live on Martin Luther King Day here to find out what's going on there as well. The other discussions we'll be having on that day here on the Mark Steiner Show. The Reverend Jamal Harrison Bryant, Dr. Bryant, who's founder and pastor of the Empowerment Temple AME in Baltimore, grew up in the Bethel AME Church
here
in Baltimore City with his father, leader of the Occupy the Dream Movement. It's a pleasure to have you in the studio, Jamal.
It's my honor. Thank you so much.
Good to have
you. Appreciate it.
Dr. Lester Spence, who wrote Stare in the Darkness, The Mist of Hip-Hop and Black Politics, also assistant professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University, is not leaving the studio. He's tied to his chair and will be here for the next hour's debate on the Republican primary.
Right.
We'll be right back. Stay with us.